Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this 16th of July. It is a Tuesday morning on a hot, sultry Tuesday, and we welcome you all to the program. I hope that I hope you're finding calm somewhere. I don't know how you do that, but feel free to pass it on. And there's a lot going on. We have a lot to discuss, a lot of big stuff. And we'll do it with a wonderful panel this morning. I'm just going to address the elephant in the room, the four male elephants in the room, which is that we have an all-male panel today. We try very hard to mix our panel as much as possible. And today was a day where we had some dropouts and we had to move some things around. So I am well aware that we have five gentlemen on the program today. And we work really, really hard on this every day. So I'm sorry that we failed you today. But don't worry. As long as everyone shows up and doesn't get sick, we'll have a much more balanced panel tomorrow as we did yesterday. And I thank you for your understanding. Now, let me introduce the group to you. And I thank you for joining us yesterday, and I look forward to finding out what is on your mind today and to see what's happening. We go to Jim Ketterer, Senior Fellow of the Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
Right. Yeah, you don't really have to go any more than that.
All right, I'm done.
Yeah,
see ya.
That's right. J.P. Miller is the man behind the very popular Empire Report, and we welcome him to the roundtable as well. Good morning, J.P., how are you?
Joe, I'm good. I appreciate being here and excited for our discussion today.
Me too. And also, we have Mike Spain with us. He is the former associate editor of the Times Union and a regular on our program and a dear friend, and we welcome you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I just want to say yesterday's extended program and the broad spectrum of people you had on the panels for the first part and the second added part were just really insightful, and it was just, I got a lot out of it, and I'm sure your audience got a lot out of it. It was a really appropriate way to respond to such a horrific event in what's going on these days.
Thanks very much. We don't quite know, in those situations what the easiest way to do, but I wanted to give voice to a lot of the people. I know we do the emails, but they can be open to interpretation and often to my snarky reading of them. I wanted to make sure that people got a voice and were heard on where they stand on this question of unity and democracy. Here's a guy I haven't seen in a really long time. Ambassador Fred Hoff is here. He's a former U.S. Army officer and State Department diplomat who taught at Bard College for 6 years and is now a senior fellow at Bard's Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Fred. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Delighted to be here. Been in light of your opening comments, I think my colleagues and I will do our best to bring to bear the requisite sensitivity to neutralize the all-male composition we have this morning.
We'll do our best, indeed. All right, let's get to it. A lot of news taking place, and we'll figure this all out this morning. I think there are so many places to start, but we'll go with J.D. Vance. Let's start with J.D. Vance. To me, the big story yesterday was, of course, the ruling from Judge Eileen Cannon in Florida. We did discuss that to a certain degree yesterday. I want to talk about it some more today, but I will keep it from being our lead story because the big news yesterday was the former president of the United States, Donald Trump, naming J.D. Vance, 39-year-old author of Hillbilly Elegy, a one-time never-Trumper, hailing from the great state of Ohio, becoming the, I believe, second youngest vice presidential choice pick ever. He was on a list that, a finalized list that included Marco Rubio, also from the state of Florida, along with the president of the former president of the United States, and now nominee of the Republican Party, and Donald Trump, and also, of course, Governor Doug Burgum. So that was the choice, and it was announced yesterday as the roll call was going on at the beginning of the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. At that point, the vice presidential pick, J.D. Vance, did a lot of media, was on the convention floor, and then was joined by Donald Trump, who appeared at the convention last night. His first public appearance after the assassination attempt on Saturday. He had a bandage over his ear, and seemed subdued, really, I think, compared to what we know of the president. But why wouldn't you be after having such a horrific thing happen to you? And of course, all of this leads us to Thursday, where former President Trump will speak and give his acceptance to the nomination. So let's go around the room of what people think of the J.D. Vance pick, and we'll begin with Fred Hoff.
Well, Joe, you know, I once believed that the MAGA movement would likely die along with the eventual passing of Donald Trump. Now I'm not so sure of that. I think that President Trump has deliberately picked someone who at least he believes can sustain this movement well into the future. As you mentioned, he's only Senator Vance is only 39 years old. He'll be around for a while, and if President Trump gets elected this November, I would imagine Vice President Vance would have a lock on the Republican nomination in 2028. I would urge our listeners to read something that I found extraordinarily interesting and informative about Senator Vance. This is Ross Douthat's June 13th, 2024 interview with Vance in the New York Times. It's reprinted in today's edition. I must say, one need not agree with everything, or for that matter, anything Senator Vance believes in to appreciate how articulate this guy is and how thoughtful he is. His ability to articulate rather complex ideas. One of the things I got out of this article is that Senator Vance seems to be absolutely sincere in his desire to make the Republican Party the party of the working class in the United States. Vance, in my view, is young, articulate, engaging. Again, I'm not talking about positions he's taking. But he is a Marine Corps veteran, and he's also a relatively recent convert to Roman Catholicism, something he has not gone out of his way to advertise. He's also a convert to the MAGA movement. The Democrats obviously are already highlighting his past criticisms of Donald Trump, some of which are quite colorful, but I really doubt that clips showing Vance criticizing Trump 8 years ago are going to produce all that many votes for President Biden. In any event, as the New York Times notes, Donald Trump may believe that there is no greater faith than that of a convert. And he seems to be very comfortable with J.D. Vance. And finally, I think it's pretty clear that President Trump is doubling down on MAGA voters, believing that they and I don't know, some quantity of additional voters will deliver a victory over the presumed Democratic nominee, President Biden. No effort, obviously, to put up somebody like Nikki Haley, who would presumably appeal to, you know, suburban women voters and so forth. He's going all the way with the MAGA base, and that that helps explain, I think, the selection of Senator Vance.
I mean, it got so silly at one point they were talking about, because Trump had mentioned it at a couple of rallies, that he would not pick J.D. Vance because he had a beard and he thought that was creepy. But it should be noted for the sake of history that J.D. Vance, if elected, will be the first vice president with a beard since Schuyler Colfax in 1869, who was Ulysses S. Grant's vice president.
Who also had a beard, didn't
who
he?
Who also, yes, at times, had a beard, yes.
Okay.
So, on those important notes, we go to Mike Spain.
I think, Fred, you summed it up really well. The two additional things that, one, I wanted to underscore what you said is how articulate J.D. Vance can be. He's very good in an interview. He was on with Sean Hannity last night again, talking really the mega points that are fundamental to the, Trump mega movement, if you want to call it that. But he seems more articulate. He explains things in a way that makes it sound more normal, if that's possible. And I think it he softens the way it comes across. But he doesn't seem to have the anger and the rhetoric when he's just talking to somebody favorable toward him like Sean Hannity. And I think that can be very persuasive to people, and certainly was one of the elements that probably ended in his, in Trump choosing him. The other question is, and again, I think you pointed to this, Fred, was that, you know, it's really revving up the mega when you pick a Vance, a younger version, a more articulate, a fresher version of the Donald Trump philosophy. Is Trump, by doing this, just doubling down on MAGA, or is he giving up on trying to convince middle-of-the-road people? I mean, is he giving up on suburban housewives, if that's ever a term anymore? But it's said to be an area where he's doing very poorly. Maybe he's going after young millennials. Maybe when younger people today, and you heard it yesterday with some of the callers into your show, Joe, with younger people, being frustrated by two old men, one who's kind of inarticulate and stumbling in his words, President Biden, and the other who seems at times crazy and wild, and former President Trump, and you don't like the idea and the optics of people that old going on for another 4 years, adding a millennial could be very appealing. And people who haven't been following all the issues, the idea that why are we spending our money on wars overseas, sending money to Ukraine? We need to put that money back here. And, you know, in America, we need to invest. I mean, I think a theme of the Hillbilly Elegy, the book that J.D. Vance wrote, the very powerful book that got a lot of attention, it was the government failed. And people have little hope. And that message may bring in a lot of young people who may not even have come out. And it's probably a really clever, smart, tactical move by former President Trump.
Michael, we're just going to go through the news here so I can hear from everybody. And then we'll take a break when we get everybody's opinion in. And we'll get news at the top of the hour. Jim Ketter.
Yeah. these are two hard acts to follow, Fred and Mike. But, Fred had mentioned recommending something to read about Senator Vance. So I would ask people to go back and take a look at something that I reread. The article is a couple of years old. It's by Tom Nichols, who spent a career teaching at the Naval War College. This is in the Atlantic magazine. And he basically makes the point that everything that Fred and Mike have said is true, that this is a talented, articulate, ambitious young person who has used those talents and that ambition as an absolute sellout, that he's not authentic in his views, that he has chosen to take this path purely as a path toward power, and that we see this with several other Ivy League educated members of both of the houses of Congress who are doing this, who Nichols says, not only ought to know better, do know better. They know better. Nevertheless, they are choosing this path in the most kind of egregious power grab, and that he sees this as particularly egregious because this is someone who is talented and held specifically different views until it was convenient to change his views to become a senator and now to become nominated for vice president.
The only thing I would like to add, I agree with you. I think the thing also is that well before a career in politics, this was one of the problems that came out very quickly after the book was released. As the book became more and more popular and people started to look at it, the accuracy of it came under great question. And what sort of the whose side are you on kind of question. The book, Hillbilly Elegy, if you have not read it, came out right after Trump was elected, and it was a way to have an explanation as to what was brewing in the country. And as a result, he was quickly picked up by CNN as a commentator. He stayed with them for about a year and a half, talking about how the country was changing and how detrimental this was going to be to the United States. And he will be selected by those in Milwaukee this week to be the vice presidential candidate on the Republican ticket.
I would also remind people, it wasn't that long ago, but that Vance was one of the first people in the immediate wake of the assassination attempt to come out with a statement that specifically pointed the finger at the Democratic Party.
In less than an hour.
And at President Biden.
Yes.
And cast blame. And so maybe that's the loyalty test that's required, but I think that is right in step with the argument that Tom Nichols is making about the choices that he has made on this path to power.
On this program yesterday, we were saying that, how the president has called for cooling of the temperature. There's been reporting that he has changed his speech to try to
Trump,
bring
you mean?
Trump,
excuse
yeah.
me.
Mm-hmm.
I apologize. Trump to bring more unity into the party. And I believe it was Jennifer Burns who said, well, we'll see how long that lasts, number one. And number two, we'll also see, because if he chooses J.D. Vance, and obviously that was just a statement.
Just about to happen.
Yeah. So, J.P.
So, did you all read the book, Hillbilly Elegy, or no?
Yes.
You did? You guys read it, or no?
No. Nope.
No, I saw the movie. Ron Howard made an interesting movie out of it.
Oh. Did you like the book?
No.
No? No. Oh. I thought it was a tremendous book, and when you read about
To be fair... I read it after the controversy of it. Okay. I read it through a lens of this portrayal may not be as advertised. So with that lens, I read it. I did not read it in the immediate aftermath of the election when I think most people read it. So I think that's fair to point out.
Gotcha. So I read it, and in hopes of, after Trump was elected, kind of in hopes, like I think many Americans did, of understanding this demographic in America. And when you read it, this gentleman grew up as poor as there are any poor people in America. He was poorer than them. And for him in 38 years to write this book, run for Senate, and yesterday get a call from Donald Trump to say, I'd like you to be the next vice president of the United States, is a remarkable rise from rags to riches.
And and go to Yale in the process.
Yes. So it is a remarkable story. In terms of the pick, vice presidents, as we know, are really important because should something happen to the president, he could be president of the United States. So he is going to have to, over the coming weeks, pass that smell test of Americans. Is this person qualified to be president should Donald Trump be elected and something happen to Donald Trump? In terms of the political reality, I think most observers would say that elections aren't decided based on vice presidential picks. Elections will be decided between Donald Trump and Joe Biden or whoever else the Democrats put up in place of Joe Biden. I do think that the political ads of J.D. Vance will be effective, of him criticizing Trump, comparing Trump to Hitler, calling Trump voters morons, saying this is detrimental to the country. I believe that those attack ads are effective. I also think that Trump picked him, as you all spoke, because he's 38 years old. He's young, and that's something that that last night at the convention, they appealed to black voters with Amber Rose. They appealed to labor with the Teamsters president. I think J.D. Vance is going to try to appeal to young people. I also note that J.D. Vance hasn't really worked with Trump before. And if he were to ask Mike Pence, how is it to be Donald Trump's vice president? Mike Pence would say, I know it's really attractive and you want to do it, but just don't do it. And I think that, you know, people say, oh,
run.
Right.
He might say, just hang in there.
Right. Yeah. Vance is going to be the next.
Nice.
You know, he's going to be the next. My view is that should Trump win and serve for 3 or 4 years, that Vance will at some point come crossways with Trump and will become a Trump, you know, antagonist like Mike Pence is now.
I mean, the one thing I will say about J.D. Vance, and then I want to take a break, but the one thing I'll say about J.D. Vance, this yesterday, but throughout the campaign, he is an incredibly articulate young man who is able to very clearly not only answer questions, further the Make America Great Again agenda, but also answer any other questions and sort of see the opposition coming and answer to it. He's very skilled at that, and I think that it'll be interesting to have him out on the, because this is not somebody like Mike Pence who was wooden, I guess, for want of a better term, and just didn't say much, and to somebody who, which may cause problems down the road too, that you have somebody who's outspoken, that may cause problems. I know a lot of people said that was one of the concerns, but let's take a break. We heard from everybody. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday, the 16th of July. It's 40 minutes past 9 o'clock. I'm Joe Donahue, along with J.P. Miller, Jim Ketterer, Mike Spain, and Ambassador Fred Hoff. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org. We would love to hear what you think of this pick, panel@wamc.org. And we'll also move on to other topics as well in our time together this morning. The idea, too, is this was I don't here are the two things I heard in the media, and I assume they're true because I believe what I read in the media.
Which media?
Silly.
One is that this was a choice that was heavily favored by Donald Trump's son, Don Jr.
He's a good friend of J.D. Vance.
They're good friends, and he had pushed this name along for a long, long time, and was very instrumental in putting J.D. Vance in situations that were helpful in showing the former president what his skill set is and could be in the future. The other thing that I thought was really interesting, and this is one I don't know whether it's true or not, but that ultimately as of 10:11 yesterday morning, the decision still hadn't been officially made, that this was a decision that did come, it seems. Now, he certainly could have been led into, you know, had a strong feeling about it, but it was not a final decision. Which I think is notable because it was post-assassination attempt where apparently the former president made this decision and said, this is the person that I want, because he was still asking others their input as late as yesterday morning.
There is some speculation that by picking Vance, it shows that Trump feels more confident that he's going to win and he doesn't have as much risk. If he had picked like Marco Rubio, for example, he's part of the establishment. He might bring in some mainstream Republicans who have doubts about Trump. He might soften the whole, sort of mega worry that a lot of Republicans might have. But by picking Vance, somebody who carries the mantle and carries the flag so well of MEGA, it indicates that Trump feels, I'm not going to lose this thing now. And perhaps that's because he's realizes, and I think quite correctly, that the assassination attempt will actually benefit him politically. It makes him look strong and tough. And it's already been exploited. You can buy the T-shirt now with the picture of him holding his fist and, standing strong when after he was being hustled off the stage on Saturday in that horrific event that killed another person and injured two others. And, it just shows that he's confident, Trump, I mean.
I think it's also interesting to ponder not just why Vance was chosen, but why the others were not chosen. What excluded them in the end? Burgum and Rubio, but also others who were in that next level down, including at least Stefanik. Why didn't they make the cut? I haven't seen any reporting on that, but I'd certainly be interested in seeing it.
Yeah, I get the sense from the from much of the reporting that that Trump does believe that Vance has the talent, has the brains to perpetuate this movement, that he brings certain strengths. But I think Mike has made the key point here. I would put it just a little bit differently. I think former President Trump has come to the conclusion, and I think he came to this conclusion even before the assassination attempt, that if his opponent is going to be President Biden, he's going to win this election. I believe he believes that very sincerely, that he is going to win. Therefore, no need to complicate the message by picking a vice presidential candidate who is going to, presumably be more appealing to, suburbanites and so forth. Just go with the distilled version of MAGA, and as long as the Democrats don't do something crazy like nominate someone else, I've got this in the bag. Whether or not he actually has it in the bag, who knows? Who knows?
4 months.
But I'm fairly confident this has played a major role in his thinking and in his selection of Senator Vance.
Yes, and if J.D. Vance does his job as a vice presidential candidate, we will see him on, I think, Wednesday night accept the nomination Correct. And give a big speech, which people will watch. You remember the speech by Sarah Palin many years ago that mm-hmm. it was, yeah. you know, definitely one that made a big impact.
It was memorable.
Unforgettable.
Unforgettable. And so that speech and then the debate, we assume that there will be one debate, as is traditional, between the two vice presidential candidates, likely at this point Kamala Harris. And other than that, it will be a race between Donald Trump and Joe Biden at this point.
By the way, I think that will be really a very interesting debate between those two. I think that Kamala Harris has not been allowed to, or she just has not shown how adept she is politically in the last 3.5 years. But if you look back at her previous debates, and you look back at some of the work that she did as a senator and the questioning she did of, you know, potential Supreme Court nominees, she is very strong in those settings. So I think it'll be, if nothing else, it'll be highly entertaining.
Yes, and their only bar that they have to clear to be better is the presidential debates between Trump and Biden, which are impossible to watch. So
right.
they will get much more in-depth on policy. She did a great job. She and Pence did a great job talking about policy 4 years ago, and this will, could be the better debate than watching the two old men arguing about whatever they argue about.
Golf.
Yes, golf. That's right.
And Jim, I'm delighted you mentioned Tom Nichols. He is a wonderful writer, and he is the person most responsible for the fact that I subscribe to the Atlantic. And I take his point. I take your point on all this. I have no doubt that Senator Vance has has exhibited measures of opportunism, cynicism, bad judgment. I don't think he's unique in our political leaders in exhibiting those qualities periodically. I would not, however, dismiss the possibility that he sincerely believes that this movement needs something more coherent than the moods of former President Trump. I wouldn't dismiss the possibility that he has a genuine sense of mission here.
J.D. Vance.
Yeah. A sense of mission that, you know, when you break it down into details, perhaps everyone in this room would disagree with some, most, or all of them. Who knows? But I would not rule out the possibility that this guy has a real sense of mission here.
I understand your point, and I certainly think he does have a sense of mission. I don't know that coherent would be the word that would pop out to me in listening to him speak.
How about less crazy? Less, you know, frenetic. Like Trump comes across and he just blasts it out. When Vance says it, he puts it in a context that makes it sound more reasonable.
But the statement immediately following
the
assassination attempt was
bad, undoubtedly bad judgment.
Yeah.
Not as bad as some of the. I mean, there's some. God help us, congressman and. In Georgia.
I saw that.
Georgia, who said, Biden.
Biden arrested.
Biden issued the order.
Well, and many members of Benny Thompson's staff were taken down, moved out because of
absolutely,
of irresponsible things that were said. So I think there's a lot of that going around on both sides, unfortunately. But,
that Vance statement could well have been bad judgment. I certainly think so. But likely good politics for the MAGA base.
Might have gotten them the job.
It may have gotten them the job, right.
And I was going to say, it certainly did not discount him from being considered as the vice president and may have gotten him over the hump.
Deborah, we're going to go to letters now. We welcome yours. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Deborah writes, my 30-year-old daughter summed it up well. I think he will really appeal to all those Rust Belt people who think that their suffering as poor white people is different than the lazy criminal minority suffering. Then we go to Lisa, who says, Vance is young, ambitious, and possibly ruthless. He may garner political and financial support. He is smart enough to be sneaky. If Trump has met his match, he will not be happy. P.S. I read Hillbilly Elegy before Vance got into politics, and for me, it did not pass the smell test. Then we go to Ellen. Everyone is speaking about just how articulate and well-educated J.D. Vance is and how impressive his rise from a disadvantaged background is. However, plenty of very articulate, well-educated people have implemented harmful policies throughout history. Absolutely. Just being articulate says nothing about the policies that the Trump/Vance administration would like to put forward, which might largely follow many of the ideas put forward in Project 25, which gets to your point, Mike, of if you make it sound more sane and are more articulate than the person at the top of the ticket.
Yeah, I think he's a new face telling the same old story, but telling it in a more, maybe a less scary kind of way. I worry that the U.S. will just completely drop support for Ukraine, if Trump gets back in with Vance
and again, I would urge the listener and others to take a look at Ross Douthat's interview from a month ago, but it's in the New York Times today. Now, Douthat is a conservative columnist. He asked some tough questions, the responses that kind of set Douthat back in all of this had to do with the 2020 election. It's clear that Douthat simply, cannot believe that J.D. Vance is sticking with the story that the election was stolen. And, Mike, when you say, less crazy, I think, Ross Douthat would agree with you across the board, except on this issue of stolen election. It's a serious issue because it's an attack. It's an attack on the political legitimacy of the United States. And that's what really makes it dangerous. And Jim, to your point about the cynicism and opportunism and all this, I have to believe that J.D. Vance knows better on this issue.
But, I think, Fred, you were saying earlier that, and Mike also, I think, said it, that Donald Trump feels like he's going to win now. He's got it in the bag, unless something really changes on the Democratic side. And so I think it's an important distinction, both who's nominated as vice president and in general, the distinction between the way that Trump and the people around him were thinking in 2016 and now. In 2016, I don't think anybody thought he was going to win, including Donald Trump. When he did win, he was wholly unprepared to take office, had no sense about the enormity that lied before him, and really had to rely on a lot of people in Washington who were unwilling to do his bidding. He's not going to make that mistake again. Right. And so whether it's Project 2025 or it's surrounding himself with people who are fully on board and, in his estimation, fully capable of doing what he wants to do, I think J.D. Vance is another sign that that's what's happening. And so this difference between not thinking you're going to win, not being prepared, and then just kind of stumbling and bumbling through 4 years. And, Tom Nichols, again, one of the things that he said that was sort of a saving grace of Trump is that he was so inconsistent and so incompetent. We can't count on that again in this next coming term, if he wins.
No, and that may be the significance of Vance. If he becomes the vice president, we may see a much more disciplined and systematic administration, which dictates that people take a look at the issues. Be careful what you vote for.
Right.
So, but we also heard the same thing about Pence. The Pence would be a more evening.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying Vance will be more evening. Vance is going to be a bulldog. He is going to help implement exactly what Trump wants to do.
Okay.
That's the distinction I'm making.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ginny writes, and this is another aspect of the J.D. Vance selection, is his wife, Usha, who is a daughter of Indian immigrants, a Hindu and former Democrat with liberal views. I see her as another person who has adopted political views merely to help her husband gain power. Then we go to Bill, who says, I read some comments by Vance saying that Ukraine should send the territory that Russia occupies to Putin and end the killing. It seems to be that allowing a criminal act like the invasion and occupation of territories that were sovereign parts of the Ukraine should not be endorsed by the executive branch of the United States government. I wonder how the ambassador feels about this.
Yeah, one hopes that Senator Vance will reevaluate this position. I mean, the lessons of history are clear. If we stand aside and let somebody of Vladimir Putin's ilk run amok in a country like Ukraine, it's not going to stop there. And sooner or later, despite all of the, you know, understandable sentiment that, oh, you know, the United States doesn't need this problem, we ought to be investing money in this, it becomes our problem, inevitably. And this is a lesson that I think doesn't have to be relearned. It's rather stark, and I think both Vance and Trump need to reevaluate their thinking about this, because there's an increasingly good possibility they're going to win this election.
Yeah, but I think it's not just Vance and Trump who hold that position, and it's not just Republicans. I mean, there is a raging debate that continues to go on in Washington about whether or not to kind of hold out for a full victory in Ukraine, or is there going to have to be some kind of negotiation? And if there are negotiations, what will that entail? It's undoubtedly going to have to entail that Putin gain some of the territory.
And Jim, I think President Biden could live with that. You know, as long as it is Zelensky.
Why doesn't he?
As long as it is Zelensky who takes, you know, who mm-hmm. takes the initiative and says, okay, it's time for some negotiations.
Why doesn't he?
I don't think he has. The political clearance, if you will, to do it yet.
Yeah, he's in the fourth year of his presidency. When's he going to do it?
I think there's a lot of pressure on him from NATO, from the Ukrainians, to make sure that the Ukrainians have what they need to defend their territory. But if, I mean, a big part of this is Vladimir Putin has expressed no interest in negotiating anything.
Right.
Putin is counting on the United States to back down.
I think it's not just Biden in a political consideration.
Yeah.
The conflict is not at the point where it's ripe for that kind of resolution.
Right. You would think that it would be quite a feather in the president's cap moving into reelection if he was able to end the war in a way that was positive for the people of Ukraine, right?
Well, and Putin, you know, Putin has to reach a parallel conclusion on all of this. It's not going to be possible to reach a negotiated settlement when the aggressor has decided, my aggression is paying dividends, no need to stop, and eventually the United States will fall into line.
We need to pause for a break at the top of the hour and also a news break with Ray Graff. We'll do so now, and we'll return on the other side. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the panel and to our discussion this morning. I'm Joe Donahue, along with J.P. Miller, Jim Ketterer. We also have Mike Spain and Fred Hoff with us, Ambassador Fred Hoff, and we love hearing from you. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will go to more letters shortly on all of these topics. I do want to bring this up because, there's a lot to talk about, and we only have until 11 o'clock. But it is... I sort of take these out of order. I do also want to talk about the security lapses and talk about what happened there, because that's obviously a huge story. So I want to touch on that. But we are we done with the Biden should
step down talk. The reporting on this has been that really since Friday and since Saturday, since the assassination attempt against former President Trump, that talk has turned to see sort of where things were going to land. But we also get reporting today, both in the New York Times and as well as CNN, that there are private efforts to nudge Biden to step aside. Those were the same nudges that he had gotten 2 weeks prior, or for 2 weeks, that yielded nothing but an "I'm not going to get out of the race," which is what we heard from him last night when he spoke with Lester Holt on NBC News. So I guess I just asked the panel's thoughts on this. Is that topic over now? Are we moving on from that topic? And I guess there's only one person who really can answer that question. But are we past that now and looking to a point? Because we even seem to be having trouble in this room of saying, well, you know, like maybe, I don't know.
We won't be past it until he accepts the nomination that night. There will continue to be talk about replacing Biden until he accepts the nomination, or until a few days before, when it's clear that there's no one else.
Now, there's some roll call voting that's going to start
August
Friday,
4th
right?
Or
I thought
it's going to They're doing that in order to make sure that
he gets on the ballot.
He's on the ballot
in Ohio.
It is Ohio. Yeah, that was, you know, technically the Democratic convention came after the deadline to file your candidacy. So they were going to technically get a Zoom call or some other way to collect delegates so he could officially be the nominee before that deadline. And so I don't know what that means as far as what you're saying, JP, if that means that once that happens, he's the candidate. Or, I mean, I think one thing we know about this year and this period that we're in is just about anything can happen.
But, you know, I think it's worth remembering that concerns about Biden's viability, not just as a candidate, but in general, and his capacity to carry out the job as candidate and as president, those concerns didn't just come up with the debate performance.
No.
That certainly highlighted it, and it brought it to the attention of a much wider audience. But you had people who were raising these concerns months ago, James Carville, David Axelrod, Ezra Klein, and they were, they were really kind of beaten down, beaten back by raising these concerns. Ezra Klein talks about being called a bedwetter by people around Biden, you know, something that I've heard on these airwaves recently as well. And so I think it's, you know, it's a way to kind of, you know, try to insulate Biden from further analysis. It's a way to shout down the people who are raising these concerns. And I think it's really unhelpful for the effort for the Democratic Party to try to win this election. I think it's also unhelpful for the health of the democracy of the country. And also, Joe Biden just happens to be the president right now. He's running the country. This is one of the most, you know, demanding, probably the most demanding jobs on the face of the planet. And so all of these, I think, are concerns, as JP said, that are going to continue, certainly up until the convention, and I think could be well past.
I mean, the other thing, too, is that you have prominent Democrats. Hakeem Jeffries went to meet with President Biden on Friday and spoke to him at length about the concerns that his members have over the president running and staying in the race. And then Saturday happened, and that just stopped. Or maybe not. I mean, as far as it's being reported, there really hasn't been anything than sort of behind the scenes chatter. And what we have heard from the very beginning, meaning post debate, was that if a change is going to be made, TikTok, we gotta work on this really, really quickly. So we're getting to a point where that window is closing,
and closing pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Peggy Noonan of the Wall Street Journal, she opposes Trump's election from a conservative point of view, and she's been quite articulate about this. Her recommendation is that the Democrats roll the dice and embrace chaos. That if they're going to,
like in '68. Have a convention.
Have an open contest. But you know, as others have indicated here, the sole decider on this is President Biden, and he seems to be firmly committed. Now, you know, is it possible that he could be talked into a different course of action? I guess. Although it strikes me that his entourage is the group of people that really wants to keep him in the presidency, because this is their turn in the sunlight. So I don't see anyone around the president suggesting that he follow a different course. My personal belief on this is that the president should have stuck with the position he established in 2020, that he's a bridge to the next generation of political leaders. He's now saying, hey, but the reason I've changed my view on this is because the job isn't done.
And Trump is still running.
In a sense, the job never gets done. The maintenance of the American Republic is an ongoing challenge. And you know, if the president were to look at the things he's been instrumental in getting passed through the Congress, I think he can make a very convincing argument that he's done his job, and it's time for the bridge to be built. But for whatever reason, he's not taking that position.
One of the things in the reporting, especially in the CNN piece, there's a direct quote from a senior Democratic lawmaker who says, we're at a point now that we feel that whenever we call for him to step aside, he's just going to dig in more. He's going to become more resolute in the fact that he's going to continue in the race. I found that vaguely chilling.
Yeah, I mean, he's a little bit like Trump has been. He sort of denies the reality that is facing him and gets angry at the people who criticize him. He was angry at Lester Holt last night, you know, when he...
How can you get angry at Lester Holt?
I know. but you know, he kept saying, why aren't you talking about, you know, the 28 lies that Trump made during the debate. Why? And Holt kept asking him if he had watched some of the debate or watched the debate afterwards. He goes, I've seen some of it. He goes, but I was there. I mean, he seems very defensive.
I'm not sure he was there.
Yeah. He seems very defensive. He seems almost in denial. What would it take to convince him that he's not going to win? Well, the polls that are continuing to come out and showing him losing in every swing state, not enough. Is it when the money stops flowing in? Who has the influence over him? What if a couple of former presidents came out and called on him publicly or went to him privately first? You know, what would it take to convince Biden that his reelection is doomed and he needs to step out of the way?
Well, one of the people who has put forward a plan, Rosa Brooks from Georgetown. This plan is also co-authored by one of the major Democratic donors and apparently is getting a lot of traction with other donors. And so, you know, I think the voice of those money people will matter quite a lot. I mean, James Carville has a similar kind of plan. It's not quite the Peggy Noonan chaos idea. It's more.
It probably would be, though.
It probably would be some. She's calling Rosa Brooks is calling it a blitz primary, and that from now up until the convention, you have a certain number of candidates who are viable, and then they let it rip, and there's a series of town meetings, and Carville is proposing something very similar, and they say this isn't just kind of a fallback plan. This would, in fact, inject dynamism and a positive attitude into this race that simply doesn't exist now, and that you could really have an opportunity to take a disaster, which is what we're seeing happening now in slow motion, and turn it into a positive.
Stanley Greenberg, a respected Democratic pollster, has sent repeated memos to the Biden campaign, sharing his take that Biden is on track to lose the election and in a way that does deep damage to other Democratic candidates, in that losing the House and the Senate as well. Lose everything is how one Democrat described a polling memo Greenberg sent to Biden's inner circle in recent days. Devastating was the one-word answer of a second Democrat close to the White House who is familiar with the Greenberg memos. The sources said Greenberg has sent several over the past 2 weeks since the president's devastating debate performance, analyzing internal polling. He asserts shows the president's position continues to deteriorate because Americans overwhelmingly do not see him as up to serving four more years. The president, with Lester Holt yesterday, said, look, I had 15 million people vote for me in the primaries, and people want me. Well, okay, but if we were to believe the polls, 75% of the people don't. They believe there should be another candidate. And also, as Alan used to say, that was then and this is now. And this is after the debate. This is after the debate performance, where new information has been brought to our attention. We can argue, obviously, Jim, that, and I agree with you, we knew a lot of this for a really long time. I remember discussions going back in the 2020 campaign about all of this, of the age and so forth. So this has been going on for a very, very long time. But again, seeing it, And more importantly, trying to be able to unsee it has proved to be very difficult.
Just can't believe your lying eyes.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's understandable, you know, the president's frustration, which he expressed to Lester Holt. You know, you're not talking about the 28 lies that my opponent told. But look, Donald Trump could have spent that whole debate reciting the Kama Sutra and the story, the lead story still would have been,
I didn't expect still, that to be brought
still,
up.
Still would have been the President of the United States, inarticulate, incoherent, and appearing to be out of it. There is no way you can avoid that being the major story. And I'm, you know, sadly, it's the story that persists.
And Lester Holt last night asked the president whether he would like another opportunity to do a debate sooner to change the dynamics, change the story, prove that you're up to the task. And President Biden declined that opportunity.
Why would he? I mean, why would he do it? You know, there's no good reason, right?
To prove that he just had a bad night.
No, I mean, why would Trump want to do a debate? I mean,
what I'm saying is Biden declined the opportunity from Lester Holt. He said he didn't want to debate him.
No, why? Yeah, well, that makes sense. Yeah.
Well, if he had just had a bad night, wouldn't you want to get out there and prove that you can capable of having a good night?
I don't know how to answer that question without being snarky.
You know, back in 1968, you know, I think there's a lot of comparisons. Of course, LBJ pulled out at the end of March, so it was a very active primary. And Robert F. Kennedy,
Senior,
pointing out, good point, had just won the California primary after I think he was defeated,
in Oregon.
And it looked like it was turning in his favor and he was going to be the candidate. And, of course, Sirhan shot and killed him that night, and it was a terrible, terrible tragedy. And there was chaos going into the convention, Humphrey delegates and McCarthy delegates, and others were throwing their hats in. And then there was political protests because it was the height of the Vietnam War. It was pretty chaotic, and Nixon benefited from all that. And he just had to look calm and quiet and firm and experienced, and he just barely won the election.
I was really taken by I'm taken by what all of our panelists say. But I was really taken by what Jennifer Burns said yesterday, in the sense that we're in a new – there was a time when that with the assassination – let's say assassination attempts of whether it was the assassination attempt on Gerald Ford or the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan. You know, you remember where you were, and we tell those stories and we see how those impact us. But now in a social media generation – that how quickly they go away. Where even I think we even saw this sort of at the beginning of 9/11, where we weren't quite as the technology was not as devoted to our cell phones and our devices and so forth. And then as world events started to go, that we were much quicker to just dismiss,
to digest it.
To digest it, to take it in, and to move on to the next thing that comes across your screen. And I still believe that image of President Trump bleeding on that stage and holding his fist in the air will be an indelible one, and one that people remember for decades to come. As I also believe that the blank stare that Joe Biden gave on the debate stage will also be something that will be ingrained in people's minds. But as far as the, you know, how this event, the tragic event of Saturday will settle with voters and be remembered one way or the other, I don't know. I find that to be an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, I think she's right. I mean, I think the half-life of news events is like accelerated beyond belief. And old news used to be years ago, maybe. Look how quickly Americans have forgotten the Führer over January 6th. No one seems to remember that or have any real particular emotions about that. It seems to be in the past. And I mean, that alone should incite people to come out and push for democracy, and it doesn't seem to be.
Well, that's also the product of a purposeful campaign
of disinformation.
Yeah. Right.
That's true.
So you're totally right about the shortening half-life of news stories, but you also immediately have the polarization and the disinformation campaigns starting, including with this assassination attempt. Including with this, from the statement of Senator Vance.
Yeah,
and we don't know as we look at this of trying to find out. You try to find the last 2 weeks. I mean, why are we not all in the fetal position, just still in bed? It's on whatever side of the aisle you're on. It's just been insane. And so to then on top of that try to move into whatever direction the Democrats, whatever direction Republicans, conservatives, liberals believe that we should move into seems to be at least momentarily halted by just this overall haze of being this barrage of information from the decision to pass on to drop the documents case to the choosing of J.D. Vance to, ..
Joe, having lived in places that are being run by authoritarian regimes, one thing that you just said reminds me that oftentimes in places where the politics are so intense, sometimes they're threatening, sometimes they're dangerous, there's a steady stream of bad news, there's a certain amount of the population, a large amount of the population, that just checks out. politics is not a topic for conversation anymore. It's too dangerous, but it's also too dispiriting. And it's not just that things become so polarized, it's that it becomes so overwhelming that people check out. And I think that's a real danger here in the U.S. as well, that could be one of the outcomes of this just constant deluge of bad news. It's not that people will hunker down and in their camps, it's that they'll just check out.
Checking out's important, though, right?
Checking, for your mental health?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I suppose.
Occasionally checking
suppose
out,
so,
but checking back in, too.
Yeah, checking back in, voting, being
paying
an engaged
for your groceries
citizen
is important.
Yeah.
You know, we got three or four letters yesterday after the show that we did, saying that putting us basically, I mean, some indirectly, some directly, saying that we were responsible for the assassination attempt on President Trump because we have been banging the drum over the last 9 years about what a horrible person this one was, likening him to Hitler, talking about the fascism. And suddenly, you know, this is another thing about what we were talking about with the quickness of the media of the, then we move on and that somehow then becomes the narrative that has been written about this particular event. Now, I think anyone in this room and most of our listeners could come up with a whole laundry list of things to counter that, and say, okay, but what about, you know, the times of joking about assassination attempts and so forth that were done on the other side. But I do wonder, it's suddenly that you become the bad guy by talking about what is happening and is going on, and somehow that if you say that this is leaning toward fascism, this is leaning toward an extraordinary overreach, looking at Project 2025, and questioning that means that you are embracing political violence. That seems to be being said more and more over the last several days, and I find that to be very disturbing.
Well, Joe, unless something has come up while we've been on the air, I don't think there's been anything really revealed yet about the motives of Thomas Matthew Crooks, the shooter. I think I can say with relative confidence he was not a listener of WAMC. So he did not get his guidance or inspiration from anything said on this station.
And I don't know this young man, but I just and is this, but knowing 20-year-olds, I mean, I just how much this does not seem to be. I think this is why both law enforcement as well as the general public are having trouble understanding any motive here is because it seems to be so mixed that there isn't that, you know, this isn't a guy who was a part there's no that we know of yet. I mean, that could change, of course, but there's no profile of anger toward one party or the other. And it just seems we know so little, and it's hard to believe that someone that is so young who seems, and I don't know that this be the case, but it certainly seems to be misguided, obviously, that of how much we read into that this was caused by questioning some very concerning aspects within our political culture.
Yeah, my sense, my fear is that this young man may fit the profile of many young men who are obsessed with having weapons of great lethality. You know, we're talking about damaged human beings trying to compensate for mistreatment and or perceptions of inadequacy. Precisely the people that firearms manufacturers have, in the past, reached out to in trying to market this weaponry. You know, if you don't have an AR-15, what kind of a man are you?
Well, the little that I agree, the little that we've seen of him, and of course this can change, he appears at first glance to be similar to what you might see a school shooter to be. Young, yeah. White, frustrated, bullied kid.
Somewhat disaffected.
With not a lot of friends, who's into video games and into guns. And this isn't expert opinion, it's just what I've read is that he seems to fit that profile more than a political activist.
Right. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue. We'll catch up here. You're listening to the Roundtable Panel. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. We're going to go into extra innings. We'll go up to 11 o'clock this morning and continue our conversation on a wide range of issues this morning. We welcome you, of course, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Jim.
Yeah, in the wait for trying to find some kind of, clear explanation as to the motive of this young man who was the shooter, I get the sense that we as a society are also hoping that there's going to be some definitive information that is not only going to explain why he did what he did, but is going to kind of let society off the hook and say, well, he was this, it was this, and it's easily explained by this, rather than saying, number one, we ought to take a very hard look at what's going on in this country and the ways in which we have allowed an ecosystem of polarization and easily flashpoint violence to take place. And it's been my concern for a long time that what we could be headed for if we don't stop this is not a kind of 1861 civil war where you've got an army on one side and an army on the other and geographic lines that are drawn, but something that I saw firsthand in the Balkans, or that Anne Applebaum has been talking about in Northern Ireland, where you have neighbors at each other, you have competing militias, you have competing senses of identity, and people being abused and in some cases attacked and in some cases killed, not because of the political positions that they take, but because of who they are. And I'm very much worried about that. And I'm worried that in trying to kind of explain away what this young man did, we are not going to look at that in the face. And the second thing is when we hear, including from President Biden, well, this is not who we are. I think that also tries to get us off the hook for what's going on now. And it's also, I think, a misreading of American history. It is, in fact, who we are.
Who we
have seen a long line of political violence throughout the history of this country. There have been times when we've dealt with it better than others. But I think there are lessons we can learn from what we've done right and what we've done wrong in the past. But we have to, as a first step, say, this is, in fact, a persistent problem in the American body politic, and we need to take it seriously beyond the motives of this one young, misguided man.
We have two letters that came in within a minute of each other, and both within the past 4 minutes. And I just think this shows us a little bit where we are. Rodney writes, I can't believe the things I'm hearing from the show. It's really hard to keep listening to the roundtable. This is how Trump won the election in 2016, because the media was doing an injustice to Hillary Clinton. All this bashing the president is doing more harm to the party than the Republicans are doing. That is Rodney. Then Chris writes, I want to say that I voted for Biden and very much admire him and all that he has accomplished for our country. Unfortunately, this dilemma also reminds when our family made the tough call to take the keys to the car away from my 89-year-old mother. She was mad at first, but we were absolutely convinced that we were saving lives by doing it. I believe that's the case here today. Thank you for your programming. It's an important voice in a world of chaos. That's it, right?
Well, it's two different points of view. Yeah.
And that seems to be
the
divide. I mean, separate from the Republican, conservative, liberal, Democrat divide, the divide within the party. Yeah.
And neither of them not necessarily wrong. Two good points, good letters, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I disagree. I don't think the first letter is a good letter. I think the idea I think it's important for us to dig into this for a minute, because the idea that we need to lockstep show some allegiance to the president because he's the president is misguided. I think it's potentially dangerous. My allegiance is to the Constitution, not to this or any president. I think if it is in fact the case, if it is that the president has severely diminished capacity, we need to address that. And we ought not to say, well, we've got to circle the wagons. And anybody else who is not circling the wagons with us is somehow disloyal to the cause and to the country. This is exactly what I was talking about that happened in the Balkans. It's exactly what happened.
Yeah, and I agree with you, Jim. I'm sorry that Rodney has difficulty listening to us, but we're not here. At least I don't see my role here as being one of shilling, for a particular political candidate. And if Rodney's wish were to come true, and we've got a panel of people here who every day are saying, vote for Joe Biden. Joe Biden has done nothing wrong. Stop leaning on Joe Biden. Rodney would probably stop listening out of sheer boredom.
We can stop calling it a panel, and we can call it a Politburo.
Well, I mean, the word that took me from that letter was bashing. And I don't see what anyone, not us, not just us, but anyone who brings up the question of age, anyone who brings up the question of the responsibility of the Biden campaign in the days and then weeks after the debate and how they responded, and the renewed calls from all corners of the Democratic Party that continue, perhaps somewhat muted now, but still continue, that we don't. But by bringing that up, we're bashing the president.
Yeah, I think it's important to underscore just what you said, and that is that we are asking appropriate questions. There is a true belief among some leading Democrats, I think Bernie Sanders has said it and others have said it, that if we don't unite now, shut up and unite now behind Joe Biden, we're going to lose everything. And it's the best path. There are people who truly believe it's the best path, even though in private, I'm sure all of them would acknowledge this is very scary and risky, and Biden has definitely shown signs of decline. Their public faces, we're going to stand united, we're going to reelect him and take it from there. And some people believe, honestly, that is the best path, as opposed to the chaos that others have, maybe described as the process to replace Biden on the ticket.
But, Mike, so there's a way to have that conversation and even that spirited debate between sides who have these different beliefs, but saying that if you don't agree with me, that you're bashing or you're a bedwetter or something like that, that's not helpful. That's not a way to engage in a serious constructive debate. That's just trying to close down somebody you disagree with.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll take our final minutes, 12 or 13 minutes left, and I would like to talk, and certainly get Fred's perspective as well as from the rest of the panel, about the security lapses that we're seeing from the and the questions of the Secret Service and their response as to what happened on Saturday with the assassination attempt on former President Trump. We will continue our conversation. We'll go to the top of the hour. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion on this. On this Tuesday morning, we have J.P. Miller, Jim Ketterer, Mike Spain, and Fred Hoff. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Much is being said about, obviously, a motive is still being sought in Saturday's assassination attempt. However, there is also a great deal of concern, I think, generally around the country and maybe even around the world, where of what happened. How did this happen? How did this happen? Kimberly Cheetle, who is the director of the Secret Service, has acknowledged that there were failures. I think that's obvious when the person that you are protecting gets shot. However, Cheetle, facing deepening scrutiny over an assassination attempt, took responsibility Monday for her agency's failure to prevent the attack, but said she would not resign. It was unacceptable, Cheadle told ABC News in an interview, her first public remarks since Saturday's bloodshed at a political rally in western Pennsylvania. The buck stops with me. Cheadle's statements were published hours after Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas called the shooting a security failure but stopped short of assigning blame, telling reporters at the White House that he had 100% confidence in the U.S. Secret Service and its director. The incident left one rallygoer dead, two others injured. Officials have said Trump has said he was struck by a bullet that pierced his right ear. The shooting in Butler was the first time since the assassination attempt on President Reagan in 1981 that a U.S. leader has been attacked while under Secret Service protection. The agency's failure to secure the rooftop used by the gunman, one of the most basic preparations for public speaking events, has raised questions about staffing, about strategy, and about leadership. Fred, I'll begin with you. Simply, how do you fail to secure the rooftop of a building that is 200 to 300 feet away from where a former president of the United States who is being protected by the Secret Service, and that is for some reason not secured?
It's absolutely inexcusable, absolutely unacceptable. If I were the director of the Secret Service, I, like the current director, would assume responsibility for this failure. But unlike the current director, I would resign immediately. Sadly, we don't have much of a tradition in this country of what the Brits would refer to as ministerial responsibility. That the person in charge should step aside when something this egregious happens. In this particular case, it appears from what we know so far, and obviously things are incomplete, but it appears that local police seem to have been assigned the responsibility for securing the outer perimeter of the area that was supposed to be secured. It seems that they failed to do so. But overall responsibility for safeguarding President Trump rested with the Secret Service. It's hard not to conclude at this point that the Secret Service failed to execute its duty. And if this is the case, then full by name accountability is called for. And again, if it were me, I would have resigned instantly had I been the Secret Service director.
Jim. Yeah, I think it's when somebody says, I take responsibility, but I'm not going to resign. So what does it mean to take responsibility? And also, the chain of command has apparently also circling the wagons. I think that either the director needs to resign or be removed. And yeah, go ahead.
I just want to interrupt to ask a question because I want to make sure, like, I have this idea in my mind and I just want to make sure that I'm correct about it. But because there's finger pointing now, and the local officials are said to be the ones who are in charge of or were responsible for securing the building. But at the end of the day, regardless of who should have done that, it is the Secret Service who is monitoring the entire operation to look down to say, was that done?
Right.
Was that not done? And to double check to make sure that it was. And that's, I guess, so, I mean, you can point and say, oh, it was those dumb local law enforcement officers. But that still doesn't take the Secret Service off.
There's no finger pointing available right now. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, doing a very detailed and transparent review of what went wrong and doing it quickly. So there's a real sense that this isn't going to be something that's going to take a year or a year and a half, but that it's going to be done very quickly. And this ought to be absolutely, and maybe it is happening, but it ought to be demanded from the White House, from the president himself. He ought to be saying we need to find out immediately what went wrong. We need to make the changes, the operational changes, but we need to make the staffing changes as well as a result of that. But I think even before that review is done, their responsibility has to be followed by action. And in that case, it would be resignation.
And I agree with what you both said. And it was we see these things cobbled together of the minutes that are going by when people said, all right, we see someone with a gun crawling on the roof. And what a tremendous lapse and a bad thing for the Secret Service. You also put that against what you saw from the agents that were close to the president who all put their lives on the line.
Absolutely.
As soon as shots fired out, they dove and put their lives in front of bullets. And also those snipers on the roof that immediately took decisive action, which is a very scary thing to, you know, these snipers sit on roofs for years doing nothing, right?
Right.
It's got to be the most boring job on the planet. And they saw the target and they neutralized the target, as you said yesterday, and very well could have saved the president's life by doing
well,
that.
Well, the life of many others in that
crowd.
Yes.
I mean, several lives. And when you listen to that, I think it's a minute and 38 seconds from the time the first shots were fired to the president being in his vehicle. In the seconds after the shooting of those shots being fired and killing the shooter, I mean, that's remarkable. I mean, it's so remarkable.
But one of the unfortunate narratives that I've seen developing in just these few days and hours is that the reason that this happened is that there were women on the Secret Service team defending the president, and that this was all a function of DEI policies that are misguided. And this is, it's reprehensible, it's ugly, it's completely without any evidence that's supporting it. Nevertheless, I think these are the kinds of narratives that happen when there's a vacuum of leadership, when there's a vacuum of solid information, and that solid information has to come from, kind of a clear process of review.
Yeah, that echoes when the bridge in Baltimore was hit by a barge, that some people in Congress were saying that the fact that Wes Moore, an African-American, was the governor and leader, and they have also an African-American mayor in Baltimore, that they're the result, inexperienced people that got to where they are because of DEI and, diversity and, equity and inclusion policies backfiring on us. It's such a trope. It is so ridiculous. I just wanted to add, it is an extraordinary innately difficult task to protect somebody who wants to be out in the public and wants to be with the people, like a candidate and a president wants to be. I'm not excusing what happened. I mean, it's not excusable. But if someone is motivated, someone has the ability to get a high-powered rifle, someone is a marksman, it is just a challenge every single time any of these people go out in public. And it needs to be analyzed quickly. It sounds like already they've beefed up security and changes have been made.
Including for RFK Jr.
Right. RFK Jr. now has Secret Service protection. I mean, the thought that, you know, his own father was the victim of a guy with a gun, you know, a crazed guy with a gun, and how that changed history. I mean, it you know, you can never do too much to protect these people.
We are unfortunately out of time, but I thank all of our panelists, Fred Hoff, Jim Ketterer, J.P. Miller, Mike Spain. Thank you all. Appreciate it. We'll be back with our next hour. Next.